Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Preisman, and I am so delighted to be joined today by Tanya James. She's the author of the novel, The Tusk That Did the Damage, An Atlas of Unknowns, and the short story collection, Aerograms. She lives in Washington, D.C., and her latest novel is called Loot. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you, Maris. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. Tanya, I think I use the term automaton so often in a derogatory way that I forgot that that could have been a cool thing at one point. And so you're writing about a time when automata was a cutting-edge technology. Tell me how you got into that. Tell me the whole thing.
Yeah, that's interesting that you use automaton as a slur. I'm trying to work that into my vocab. But I think that probably the way people thought about automatons at that time is sort of maybe similar to the way we think of AI to some extent, that there was this fear about playing God. I mean, there's the kind of, you know, religious fear, but there was also a kind of fear of industrialization and all these kind of people whose livelihoods were by their hands and they could be replaced by these automatons. There are these sophisticated ones that were popular in Europe in the 1600s and 1700s, and they could, you know, play a flute, like a lady could play a flute, and her mouth was looked very, like, you know, pretty accurate simulation of an actual person's mouth, and just like really, really sophisticated automaton. And I discovered this one, Tipu's Tiger, in a book. And I was struck by, first of all, it's not very sophisticated looking in the way that these other ones are, these European ones. It's a 6-foot wooden mechanical tiger that's sort of mauling the throat of an English soldier. And the soldier doesn't have a very realistic face. He's just kind of like round eyes and like a kind of sad pumpkin, sort of like a jack-o'-lantern face, you know, but there's something about the comedy of it, the dark comedy of it, that felt very contemporary. And I was drawn to it. I just thought there's something about this anti-colonialist irreverence that I'd never seen before. And I still haven't seen anything like it from that time. So I wanted to investigate it.
Amazing. And so much of your novel is based on fact. But you, of course, fictionalize some of the characters. But I'm wondering if you could take us into the history a little bit about Tipu Sultan.
Yeah. So Tipu Sultan was the ruler of Mysore around the end of the 1800s. And he basically, at that point, it was sort of a hinge moment in the history of British Empire, because until that time, they had control of the north and the east, but only around 9% of the landmass, which is not that much. But they really wanted the southern peninsula. And he and maybe one other faction was standing in their way. So they fought a total of 4 wars. And he and his father, Haider Ali, they were extremely strategic and sort of visionary in the way that they copied French military tactics. That's why they were able to kind of, you know, get as far as they did. But ultimately, the British East India Company, the British forces in the final 4th and final war, they destroyed the capital city. They took out Mysore completely. And that was the sort of turning point for the British East India Company, because after that, they became the sort of this aggressive capitalist sort of superpower. And so the novel kind of begins at that turning point with Tipu Sultan kind of grasping at these kind of last straws of power.
Absolutely. I sort of love that part of his idea, along with borrowing French military strategy, is actually looking at trying to help his fellow community members learn from the English and the French, and with the hopes that one day they could surpass. And that seems like where Abbas comes in.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot written about Tipu Sultan. I mean, there's not a whole lot of his own writing about himself or his speeches or anything like that. But the fact that he came up with rockets and the fact that he came up with all kinds of, I mean, he had all these just visionary ideas about what his kingdom could be and what they could do. So it helped me kind of shape this idea of a guy who was, on the one hand, very brutal, had a lot of, weaknesses as a ruler in terms of that sort of violence and unnecessary ruthlessness. On the other hand, he really was interested in technology. And so he actually did have commissioned this, it's kind of strange, automaton. And so then I thought, I was actually, the novel doesn't focus so much on him as the automaton itself. And I kept thinking, I'd love to write like a Jim Shepard-esque, Hilary Mantel-esque kind of deeply researched novel about the makers of this automaton. And then I quickly came to realize that we have no idea who made this automaton. We know it's probably a combination or a collaboration between a French clockmaker or engineer and a local woodcarver. And so I just kind of came up with this character out of thin air, really.
I mean, and I love him. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about one of my favorite things in this book is that there are little sketch drawings, which is so important when there's something visual being brought to life. Tell me about them. Did you draw them?
I can take partial credit. Well, first of all, thank you for asking me about those. Nobody's asked me about those. Have you read David Mitchell's novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet?
No.
It's a really wild, like it's historical fiction set in 1799 in Dejima in Japan. And it's, sort of following somebody who's in the company of the Dutch East Indies. But he has these just like two or three images throughout the novel. And I love the way the image kind of, I don't know what it is. It's hard to kind of articulate the effect that those had on me because it does take you out of the text. It does take you out of the project of mentally imagining what's going on. But at the same time, I think that there's an element of playfulness to it, kind of like meta textuality. And I just kept thinking, I know I'm writing about heavy stuff, but I want to have fun. How can I have fun with this material? And images are just a way to do that. So the first image is Abbas drawing a sketch of the automaton. And it's a kind of pivotal moment because he doesn't yet trust himself to be able to do this. He's very afraid of making a mistake. And so it was just another way. It's also a way to kind of suspend time because the reader has to pause and look at this thing before they're continuing on reading. So a lot of that was just me tracing over images I had found. Again, there's another huge automaton called the Elephant Clock, and I was just tracing over, someone else's image. But it's just another way to kind of inject a little bit of something unexpected and to slow us down. And it's just sort of also reminded me of not children's books, but there's that style of like 1800s kind of like novels where you'll see like a little sketch or hit a corner. And it's just another place for your eye and your mind to go.
I love that. And I like that. I'm assuming you made this up for him, and that's wonderful, that one of the reasons that Tipu Sultan wants this elephant clock to be made, he says, is to provoke among the masses a sense of awe and its close cousin, obedience. And that is such a powerful description of what Duff can do.
Yeah, I think he really was into, I don't think he actually commissioned the elephant clock. I kind of created this moment, but I
got it.
But I think he would have really responded to that object. That was created and designed by a 12th century Muslim polymath. His name is Al-Jazari, and he is well known, I think, in the Arab world, but I don't know. I mean, I didn't know about him. But when I discovered this thing, this was a whole other world of automatons that I had not read about. I had only associated automatons with Europe. But here he was doing it in the 1100s. And I think that Tipu Sultan would have been really attracted to this idea behind the elephant clock, which is that each part of it represents a certain part of civilization, but none of those civilizations he's mentioning are European. And so I felt like that he would have been really attracted to, though I didn't find that anywhere in historical record. I just made that up, that he had that commissioned.
I love that. And yeah, you create this tension in this first part of the book and second, in that we don't know who to trust. He doesn't know who to trust. Are the French allies? Will they be betrayed? And then tell me about the political climate, I guess, as we begin.
Well, in the beginning of the novel, France is, Tipu Sultan is constantly asking for help from France to aid him and give him money and give him soldiers to fend off the British. He knows that you know, there's a bit of stasis between the Third and Fourth War, but he is prepared to kind of confront the British one more time. And so so he has a lot of French. He has a lot of French expats at his court. He has a lot of French engineers and people who can, you know, he was really trying to build up a navy even. Nobody had ever done that in India at the time. So by the time, at that point then, in 1799, once Tipu is defeated, Abbas himself, he attempts to leave India. And I think he doesn't anticipate how complicated leaving will be. And so he joins a East India Company ship as a carpenter, but he actually winds up on a French pirate ship and is sort of conscripted or, you know, pressed into labor on a French ship. And so he kind of plays all these. I think one of the things he comes to feel strongly by the end of this journey, by the time he gets to England, is that it's every man for himself. There's no such thing as this is my national identity and I'm from here and I'm loyal to this country, this nation. He comes to not care about any of that. Whereas at the beginning of the novel, he cares pretty deeply about being loyal to Tipu Sultan.
Absolutely. And so one of the things that you do in this novel is you give him such wonderful relationships. And so at the start, he is kind of mentored by Monsieur Dulez. And it's a friendship that evolves over only, 30 or 40 pages or so. But you really feel it. Hmm. Tell me about them.
I mean, I felt like all of the characters whose consciousnesses I was interested in, they're all ostracized in some way, or they're secretly, they somehow feel outside of the world that they're a part of. He is a clockmaker and a maker of automatons. He arrives at Tipu's court because Tipu invites, he wants clockmakers to come from France. So Louis XVI sends him. But by the time he gets to India, soon after that, there's the French Revolution and subsequently a law that was an actual law that was passed that banned French, especially, you know, royalist French people or aristocrats from coming back to France. And so he's sort of exiled and sort of stranded in France, in Mysore for a long time. And he doesn't quite fit in with the other expats, and because he's somewhat closer to Tipu Sultan. And so he doesn't stay where the other expats and soldiers stay. He kind of has his own apartment, and he has a sort of artistic lonerness about him. And he sees something in Abbas. He doesn't know for sure if Abbas is that talented. He kind of takes a chance on him. But then I think Abbas comes to save his life in a way. And they become kind of mutually indebted to one another. I really like I have not seen so much this relationship in fiction of the mentor. I feel like I see it in film, and maybe it's a kind of archetypal relationship in film. And maybe it's just simply what I've been drawn to lately. But I was interested in that relationship between mentor and mentee. And some of it is not, it's not entirely pure all the time. I think Abbas at one point is thinking of Deleuze in a sense, like in a almost greedy kind of sense, like, I want what you have. I had a friend, he was 15, and he just saw somebody doing capoeira in the street, and he just was so mesmerized by it. And he became that person's student. And he basically said to him, I want what you have. And he now is a capoeira teacher himself. But I just took that one line. I was like, that's really what it boils down to a lot of the times. It's as a younger person or as a novice, you look at that person who seems to have mastered and have such confidence and you want it so badly. That felt so one of those kind of personal ways into character for me.
Absolutely. And even just the metaphor of making a clock or repairing a clock seems like it's the kind of thing where you have to be so, what's the word I'm looking for?
I follow that metaphor. I do have to like kind of be very still and rigorous. And
it seems like there's this great tension between what is this stuff? This is just stuff. And Abbas's wish to create something that will last, and people don't last.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine having that kind of ambition to make a thing that will outlast me. Maybe that's because we're a product of our time. Everything seems more ephemeral now than it ever has.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he is maybe a product of his times, and he's, you know, I think one of the first things that he encounters in the novel that makes him feel that way is a verse from a poet, which was an actual verse from an actual poet. And it just, I think it's just, that it just works some kind of magic on him. And he wants to replicate that feeling in someone else, that kind of feeling of wonder. I think as the novel goes on, he becomes, you know, almost irrationally attached to this object that he made. But by the end of the novel, I think he comes to really has to sort of come back to that sense of wonder, which has not so much to do with the thing that was made, but more the feeling of boundlessness, that you're on the verge of something, that is where the spirit of artistry kind of lies.
I love that. And then, of course, on the opposite end of the spectrum is Lady Selwyn, who is such a fun character to read. And she's like the stereotypical European woman who likes to exoticize everything. I mean, the term is Orientalism. Tell me about her.
I think that I did begin from that stereotype. She was just a fun way for me to make fun of a certain type of person. I just enjoyed the voice. The voice kind of changes a little bit depending on whose perspective it is. And I felt like when I was near her consciousness, I was inhabiting some other personality almost. Like I was reading this book by Virginia Woolf that isn't that popular, I think, but it's called Flush, and it's a biography of her dog.
Yep.
It's so funny. Like, she's so funny. But most of what I read of hers is not funny, but I mean, I love Mrs. Dalloway, but I thought Flush really had this kind of pomposity about it, but self-aware pomposity that I really liked. And I also just thought, I knew that there was something, the two things for me that felt like doorways into her character were the fact that she smokes these strange pipes, these kind of manly pipes called meerschaums. It just was the kind of idiosyncrasy that it made her a little more interesting. But then also that she is a novelist of her own. And in that way, I think she is, again, something of ostracized person, and that, well, at least ostracized in her own mind, because she can never share it with anybody. She can't let anybody know that she's written a romance novel, because that would put her, you know, reputation at risk. And she's a sort of wealthy kind of dowager type of lady. She can't be considered unserious in that way. So in some ways, I feel like all of these characters are, you know, unable to kind of express something that's essential about them. And that's sort of something they chafe against.
Absolutely. And one of the nicest surprises in the book is that Jihan reads this novel and loves it.
Yeah.
If you're doing a stereotypical thing, she would have written something awful. And the idea that they could both, you know, they have some things in common.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of a revelation.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought, thank you for observing that. I kind of felt like if it was a bad novel, she'd just be a fool not to be taken seriously. And I think, you know, by a certain point, if I'm going to invest in someone in writing from their perspective, I want them to have some dignity. I mean, they can be foul in every way. They can be, you know, kind of unlikable, whatever. But I feel like dignity is something important. And I liked giving her the dignity of not of being actually right about her value as a writer. She might be wrong about herself in every other way, but in this one way, you know, and sort of the one person who she has a romantic attachment to just refuses to see it and can't see it, because in some ways, I mean, it is Orientalist. She's a product of her time. She's written a romance novel in which he falls in love with a, you know, I don't know, I think he's a genie or something.
Yeah.
It's kind of silly on the surface, but for the times, it's like it's a pretty sexy novel. And it's sort of sad to her that of all the things she owns, all her collections, all her books, she can't put her own work on display.
And of course, there's something alluring there for Jihan too. I'm thinking about how we spent this entire time talking, we haven't gotten to her yet. And how to, I'm not going to try to trace my way to her and all of the steps she takes. But you do draw out this budding relationship that she seems to have with Abbas.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at first I was writing, I was like, is this realistic that she meets him when she's something like 14 or something? And from the moment she meets him, she just never forgets him. But then I thought, I don't know. I actually think that that's possible. And she goes through such an extraordinary and kind of, you know, traumatic number of experiences. Being she's born to a French expat engineer and a Mysorean woman who dies in childbirth, and she is taken to France. She basically knows, you know, is friends with no one there, is made fun of for being half Indian, and doesn't really find, you know, doesn't really find a peer in this world until Abbas suddenly shows up on her doorstep. And I thought that itself is so magical, to kind of re-encounter him again so many years later. And I thought maybe, you know, maybe in this world it is possible that to see someone, you know, from, you know, 20 years ago or so many years ago. And I think it's probably realistic, I think, to have this sudden, intimate, you know, connection. And I think of her as an artist, but sort of the more kind of pragmatic of the two. Like, she's romantic, but she's also pragmatic about, you know, her art and wanting to make it be commercial and sellable and wanting to live and just get by.
But one of the first things that Abbas does for her is make her a top, a toy. And I found that you could like really see her holding on to that sense of wonder and possibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the point where 20 years later, they're the same people.
Yeah, you're so right. I think she's pragmatic in her work, but not about her, like her dreams of, you know, of finding, you know, finding family in him.
And I'm trying to think how to ask you this, because I don't want to. Jihan and Abbas plot something of a heist, and it doesn't go according to plan, as heists are wont to do.
And so I'm wondering, one, if like putting them in Lady Selwyn's home, what kinds of contrasts you can make, what we find out about Abbas and Jahan just from being in the presence of this succubus, I would say. And then we don't have to get into the actual action of it. It's very good. You'll have to read it, listeners.
Well, one thing that's interested me is the hierarchy of the English country house, and it's like a literal hierarchy. Like there's certain people, I mean, as we all know from Downton Abbey, certain people live upstairs and certain people live downstairs. And Rum, who is Lady Selwyn's secret romantic partner, he's also from India. He's from South India. And he is her steward. He's sort of her second in command. He sort of occupies this in-between space because he's having this secret affair with her. And then so Jeanne is on the upstairs because she's, you know, a visitor and she's kind of pretending to be a lady. And Abbas is downstairs in the cloisters with all the other servants. And I just thought there's something about all of these people being on different levels, conspiring in different ways. So Jeanne and Lady Selwyn have their own kind of relationship that Rum is worried about because he imagines himself being displaced. But and then Abbas and Rum are connecting because of their shared backgrounds. And I just thought there's a way in which the house is the central, the sort of succubus is still there. The automaton is still kind of their focus. But in some ways, it's creating all these other strange kind of chess moves in the house. And they're all contained to the house. There's nowhere else to go. So I kind of liked how in the first half of the novel, kind of moving across time and countries and oceans, and then suddenly the novel sort of contracts and tightens its focus. I wasn't sure. At first I thought, does this feel like different novels in one novel? But I just sort of went with it and hoped that the reader would come along with me.
Sure did. Tanya, thank you so much. Before we go, would you please recommend some books for us?
I would love to. Okay, so I don't know about you, Maris, my brain has been, I've been sort of fractured and all over the place. And I've been looking for a novel to kind of swallow me whole. And I don't know why, I just thought maybe not short stories right now. But then I picked up this book, Lesser Known Monsters of the 21st Century by Kim Fu. Oh my gosh, the first story, it knocked me out. I can't, it's called Pre-Simulation Consultation. And it's basically about grief and, you know, someone grieving their mother, but it's also about, you know, about wanting to enter a simulation with their mother. And it's entirely dialogue. I mean, I feel almost kind of proselytizing about this one. And I've only read the first story, so I'm excited about it.
Perfect.
Another novel I loved was Our Country Friends by Gary Steingart. Did you read that one?
I did. Ooh. I did.
Oh my God. It's so funny and a heartbreaker. And why am I not surprised? But I also read Breakup, which is a memoir by Anjan Sundaram. And he is a war correspondent, or he was at the time of this writing, in Central African Republic. And it's basically about this sort of the moral responsibility of being a war correspondent when he also had a wife and young child at home in Canada, and sort of being torn between these two things. So, I mean, he's just, it's really, really gripping. And yeah, those are my three.
I love it. Tanya, thank you so much. Loot is out now.
Thank you, Maris.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.